The hopes and fears of our time are alike due to the operation of new science and new technique upon old human nature, which is not changing as fast as the new circumstances require. But in this broadcast, I shall be concerned with hope, not with fears. I shall be concerned to say what good things may happen if there is a modicum of wisdom in the conduct of human affairs. I do not pretend that there is any way of arriving at the millennium. Human life cannot be made a matter of unalloyed bliss, but the permissible hopes are very considerable, and it is these that are my theme. Scientific technique can confer two kinds of benefits. It can diminish bad things and increase good things. Scientific technique can abolish poverty and excessive hours of labor. Whether it does so or not depends upon whether it coexists with democracy. Where it does not, as in Russia, it may be used to facilitate despotism, to spread forced labor, to fasten a new form of serfdom upon the population, and to increase social and economic inequality. In the West, fortunately, the growth of industrialism has coincided with the growth of democracy. It is possible now, if the population of the world does not increase too fast, for one man's labor to produce much more than is needed to provide a bare subsistence for himself and his family. Given an intelligent democracy, not misled by some dogmatic creed, this possibility will be used to raise the standard of life. It has been so used to a certain extent in Britain and America, and would have been so used more effectually but for the war. Its use in raising the standard of life has depended mainly upon three things: democracy, trade unionism, and birth control. If these three things can be extended to the rest of the world as it becomes industrialized, and if the danger of great wars can be eliminated, poverty can be abolished throughout the whole world, and excessive hours of labor will no longer be necessary anywhere. But without these three things, industrialism may create despotic slave states, like that in which the pharaohs built the pyramids. If a good world is to be created and sustained, a certain kind of mental disposition will have to be widely diffused. This disposition will have to be partly intellectual and partly a way of feeling. There must be in many the desire to know the important facts, and in most an unwillingness to give assent to present illusions. There must be an absence of fanaticism and a realization that our beliefs may be mistaken. This unfanatical temper involves certain sacrifices. If you believe some dogmatic creed with such intensity that you are prepared to face martyrdom, you can live a happy life and even enjoy a happy death if it comes quickly. You can inspire converts. You can create an army. You can stir up hatred of opposing dogmas. And generally, you can seem immensely effective. I am constantly asked, what can you, with your cold rationalism, offer to the seeker after salvation which is comparable to the home-like comfort of a fenced-in dogmatic creed? To this the answer is many-sided. In the first place, I do not say that I can offer as much individual happiness as is to be obtained by the abdication of reason. I do not say that I can offer as much happiness as is to be obtained from drink or drugs or amassing great wealth by swindling widows and orphans. It is not the happiness of the individual convert that concerns me. It is the happiness of mankind. If you genuinely desire the happiness of mankind, certain forms of ignoble personal happiness are not open to you. If your child is ill and you are a conscientious parent, you accept the medical diagnosis, however doubtful and discouraging. If you accept the cheerful opinion of a quack and your child consequently dies, you are not excused by the presentness of your belief in the quack while it lasted. If people loved humanity as genuinely as they love their children, they would be as unwilling in politics as in the home to let themselves be deceived by comfortable fairy tales. All fanatical creeds do harm. This is obvious when they have to compete with other fanaticisms. since in that case they promote hatred and strife. But it is true even when only one fanatical creed is in the field. It cannot allow free inquiry, since this might shake its hold. It must practice some form of persecution of those who dislike fanaticism. It must oppose intellectual progress. It must give power to a caste professionally devoted to the maintenance of the intellectual status quo and to a pretense of certainty where, in fact, there is no certainty. There are some things that our age needs and some things that it should avoid. It needs compassion and a wish that mankind should be happy. It needs the desire for knowledge and the determination to eschew present myths. It needs, above all, courageous hope and the impulse to creativeness. The things that it must avoid and that have brought it to the brink of catastrophe are cruelty, envy, greed, competitiveness, search for irrational subjective certainty, and what Freudians call the death wish. The root of the matter is a very simple and old-fashioned thing, a thing so simple that I am almost ashamed to mention it, for fear of the derisive smile with which wise cynics will greet my words. The thing I mean, please forgive me for mentioning it, is love, Christian love, or compassion. If you feel this, you have a motive for existing, a guide in action, a reason for courage, an imperative necessity for intellectual honesty. If you feel this, you have all that anybody should need in the way of religion. Although you may not find happiness, you will never know the deep despair of those whose life is aimless and void of purpose. For there is always something that you can do to diminish the awful sum of human misery. I will say a few words about the connection of compassion with intellectual honesty. There are several different attitudes that may be adopted towards the spectacle of intolerable suffering. If you are a sadist, you may find pleasure in it. If you are completely detached, you may ignore it. If you are a sentimentalist, you may persuade yourself that it is not as bad as it seems. But if you feel genuine compassion, you will try to apprehend the evil truly in order to be able to cure it. The sentimentalist will say that you are coldly intellectual, and that if you really minded the sufferings of others, you could not be so scientific about them. The sentimentalist will claim to have a tenderer heart than yours, and will show it by letting the suffering continue rather than suffer himself. The men who made the Munich surrender would have pretended, A, that the Nazis didn't go in for pogroms, B, that Jews enjoy being massacred. And fellow travelers maintain, A, that there is no forced labor in Russia, B, that there is nothing Russians find more delectable than being worked to death in an Arctic winter. Such men are not coldly intellectual. The most disquieting psychological feature of our time, and the one which affords the best argument for the necessity of some creed, however irrational, is the death wish. Everyone knows how some primitive communities, brought suddenly into contact with white men, become listless and finally die from mere absence of the will to live. In Western Europe, the new conditions of danger in which we exist are having something of the same effect. Facing facts is painful, and the way out is not clear. Nostalgia takes the place of energy directed towards the future. There is a tendency to shrug the shoulders and say, "Oh, well, if we are exterminated by hydrogen bombs, it will save a lot of trouble." This is a tired and feeble reaction, like that of the late Romans to the barbarians. It can only be met by courage, hope, and a reasoned optimism. There is good basis for hope. Leaving on one side for the moment the danger of war, the average level of happiness in Britain as well as in Australia and America is higher than in any previous community at any time. Moreover, improvement continues whenever there is not war. We have, therefore, something important to conserve. And Britain and America between them have the highest level of scientific and technical skill. There is reason to hope that this skill may find an adequate defense against bombs, in which case the whole outlook for mankind would be radically improved. We ought to be devoting the best available brains to this end. What I do want to stress is that the kind of lethargic despair which is now not uncommon is irrational. Mankind is in the position of a man climbing a difficult and dangerous precipice, at the summit of which there is a plateau of delicious mountain meadows. With every step that he climbs, his fall, if he does fall, becomes more terrible. With every step, his weariness increases, and the ascent grows more difficult. At last, there is only one more step to be taken, but the climber does not know this, because he cannot see beyond the jutting rocks at his head. His exhaustion is so complete that he wants nothing but rest. If he lets go, he will find rest in death. Hope calls. One more effort. Perhaps it will be the last effort needed. Irony retorts, silly fellow, haven't you been listening to hope all this time and see where it has landed you? Optimism says, while there is life, there is hope. Pessimism growls, while there is life, there is pain. Does the exhausted climber make one more effort, or does he let himself sink into the abyss? In a few years, those of us who are still alive will know the answer. Dropping metaphors, the present situation is as follows. Science offers the possibility of far greater well-being for the human race than has ever been known before. It offers this on certain conditions. Abolition of war, even distribution of ultimate power, and limitation of the growth of population. All these are much nearer to being possible than they ever were before. In Western industrial countries, the growth of population is already almost nil. The same causes will have the same effect in other countries as they become modernized, unless dictators and missionaries interfere. The even distribution of ultimate power, economic as well as political, has been nearly achieved in Britain, and other democratic countries are rapidly moving towards it. The prevention of war? It may seem a paradox to say that we are nearer to achieving this than ever before, but I am persuaded that it is true. In the past, there were many sovereign states, any two of which might at any moment quarrel. Attempts on the line of the League of Nations were bound to fail, because one side was too proud to accept arbitration and the neutrals were too lazy to enforce it. Now there are only two sovereign states, Russia with satellites and the United States with satellites. If either becomes preponderant, either by victory in war or by an obvious military superiority, the preponderant power can establish a single authority over the whole world and thus make future wars impossible. What stands in the way? Not physical or technical obstacles, but only the evil passions in human minds. Suspicion, fear, lust for power, hatred, intolerance. I will not deny that these evil passions are more dominant in the East than in the West, but they certainly exist in the West as well. The human race could, here and now, begin a rapid approach to a vastly better world, given one single condition: the removal of mutual distrust between East and West. I do not know what can be done to fulfill this condition. Most of the suggestions that I have seen struck me as silly. Meanwhile, the only thing to do is to prevent an explosion somehow and to hope that time may bring wisdom. The near future must be either much better or much worse than the past. Which it is to be will be decided by the whim of a few individuals in the Kremlin. This may sound unscientific, but it is true.